welcome to the Free Movement Podcast. This is your February roundup. I'm your host, Sonia Lenigan, and my co-host is Colin Yeo. Colin, how are you today?
Hi, Sonia. I'm fine. I'm enjoying the fine weather here in Bristol.
Yeah, I think we've got sunshine here as well, which is very exciting. Okay, so today we are going to start off, I think, as we usually do, which is with asylum. And the first one we're going to look at is from last week, and that is the latest quarterly statistics release. So the article is Number of Asylum Refusals and Homeless Refugees Skyrocket in Latest Statistics. Asylum refusals absolutely shot up in the last quarter of 2023, which is, as Colin and I have discussed, I think several times before, as expected, because with the backlog clearance, obviously the Home Office was looking to decide the easy cases first, the easy grants from high grant nationalities, and then they left the more difficult refusals for last. And so we've seen that reflected in the statistics. Another interesting thing I spotted was that Home Office presenting officer attendance at asylum appeals is down from 99% to 90%. That is for the year 2022 to 23. So it's a bit delayed. We don't know what the current situation is, but it's difficult to imagine that it's got better just because nothing seems to with the asylum system nowadays. We've also seen that there are huge delays in fee waiver applications. Again, that is something that anyone doing those is very aware of at the moment. There's also been huge numbers of EU settlement scheme applications rejected as invalid. The number of students dropped in the last quarter of 2023, which is before the restrictions on them bringing dependents were brought in. So it's going to be interesting to see whether that drop continues and to what extent. And as we know, there are lots and lots of health and care workers, and that was also reflected in the statistics. I think there are probably some other interesting things. I would like to go and look at returns in a lot more detail and sort of try and unpick all of that, but I didn't do that last week. So that's a future job. The next one is you, Colin.
Yes. So this is a depressing but very useful piece by Larry Locke on how the Nationality and Borders Act has criminalised those seeking safety in the UK. And it kind of, unless you're an asylum lawyer, you probably assume that arriving in a small boat is a criminal offence, but it wasn't until fairly recently. There was a good reason for that, but the government has decided to legislate. And although we discussed this on the podcast previously, the Nationality and Borders Act is kind of dead in lots of ways. The whole sort of idea of differentiated treatment has been dropped. The age assessments appeals haven't been commenced and probably never will by the looks of things, and so on. But the one really sort of poisonous bit of its legacy is this criminal of basically everybody who arrives to claim asylum. And as Larry explains, he kind of tracks through what the legal changes were that have led to the change, and also looks at and links to the various cases, which is very useful. And he explains that it's not so much asylum seekers who are facing prosecutions so far under this, because what the government's done is it's criminalised basically arriving to claim asylum. The main purpose seems to have been to therefore make sure that it was criminalised where you assist somebody who claims asylum. And basically it's these hand on the tiller cases, as we've called them a few times, where somebody has been observed, often with a drone or something like that, steering a boat. And then that's considered to be an aggravating factor. They're prosecuted under Section 25 of the 1971 Act as amended, rather than 24, which is the illegal entry. Although, and I really recommend having a look at Larry's piece, because I'm not really doing it justice or trying to talk it through quite quickly. But he explains that, you know, there have been, it's not formal plea bargaining as such, but, you know, there have been people who've been charged potentially with Section 25 offences. Hasn't necessarily been enough evidence to make it stick, but they've ended up pleading guilty to Section 24 offences instead. So it's not actually a very long read, but there's a lot of dense information packed into it, and I really recommend people have a look. Oh, there's another one from me. I was just pausing there, but actually there's a sort of follow up, a briefing that I reissued because of this horrendous Alkali attack that was in the news a few weeks ago now. And there's an old piece that I wrote on whether criminals can be denied refugee status, and I thought I would update it in a sort of quite neutral way, so it doesn't really refer to this particular case. But it talks you through how the Refugee Convention works and the exclusion clauses of that, and it contrasts it with human rights law, which doesn't have those kinds of exclusions for bad people, basically. I make reference to the drafting history of the Refugee Convention and the historical reasons why some people are excluded from its protection, even though they would otherwise meet the criteria for refugee status, and look at what the test is, and essentially it's whether it's a particularly serious crime. I felt that the Home Office had been rather misleadingly briefing the press, shock horror, at the time of this offence, because they were pointing journalists to its serious harm policy, but that's not actually the policy. It's the particularly serious harm policy that's relevant. Serious harm is kind of different legal test in a different context. It's not the refugee exclusion test. So yeah, if you're interested in these things, if you want to kind of prime on how it all works, then that piece is for you.
Next is me, and this is Home Secretary confirms pause on processing asylum claims. The affected claims with this pause, it's people who've arrived on or after the 1st of January 2022. The significance of that date is that is the date from which the government first said arrivals would be sent to Rwanda. So when they announced Rwanda in April 2022, they said it would apply to people who'd arrived on or after the 1st of January that year. And to be in this paused group, people must have also received a notice of intent before the 29th of June 2023. And that is when the Court of Appeals decision in the Rwanda litigation was given. The Home Office has said that people who've arrived between those dates who have that notice of intent saying that they're being considered for Rwanda, those cases will not be processed. I think possibly they have publicly announced this pause in particular because of the XY decision that we spoke about in last month's podcast, where they had paused cases and not told anyone about it. And that's obviously a very unlawful thing to do. So they got in a lot of trouble for that. It seems that they're just trying to avoid being in the same position with this pause on decision making. I am still unclear about how this relates to another pause on cases, which has been reported both by journalists and lawyers who've been made aware of it. And this is a pause on cases from the 7th of March 2023, which is when the illegal migration bill was published. So that pause has not been officially confirmed. I wonder if this might be because the Home Office does not consider that it needs to, because the Illegal Migration Act precludes them from a grant of leave. So possibly their position is, well, this is not a secret. They can't be granted leave. It's in the Illegal Migration Act. Who knows? I'm just speculating. At some point, we will no doubt find out. Moving on to a couple of trafficking cases I'm just going to briefly mention. The first one is deportation exclusion in discretionary leave policy for victims of modern slavery found unlawful. Now, this one relates to the pre-30th of January 2023 position. And actually, I'm going to stop here and say, Colin, the National Indian Borders Act has actually been hugely damaging for people who are victims of trafficking. It's made everything so much more difficult for them. So it's definitely not, it's still a very live and damaging bit of legislation for anyone who has been trafficked. Every time you say National Indian Borders Act is dead, I'm always going to make this point. Back to this case. Yes, so the discretionary leave guidance on granting victims of trafficking leave had excluded people who were subject to deportation proceedings, and that was held to be unlawful. The next case is risk of re-trafficking must be assessed before disqualification on public order grounds. So again, this is another change that was brought in under the National Indian Borders Act. And essentially, there's been a guidance change following a judicial review, which was conceded by the Home Secretary. And now, before disqualifying someone from trafficking support on the basis that they are a threat to public order, the Home Office must carry out an assessment of the risk of re-trafficking. And that process is set out in some detail in the updated guidance. And I've also explained that in the article. There have been so many successful challenges to these trafficking changes that were brought in last year, I think it's really interesting to watch how it's all been evolving. So yeah, those are the latest two cases on those changes.
Yeah, it's a really good point about the impact on trafficking victims. And you do infinitely more trafficking work than me, so you're in a much better position to judge. I was kind of under the impression that a lot of the really bad stuff was basically being reversed following all of these legal challenges. Is that sort of fair assessment, or am I being a bit optimistic?
There's been a lot of success, but you still see that you can still see the impact in the statistics, in particular, of the Nationality and Borders Act. And while we're on that topic, I suppose, I'll mention that yesterday I did a very short write-up of a new report from Callaghan, and they talk there about the impact of the Nationality and Borders Act and how it imposes a higher evidential burden on people. And so more work has been spent on preparing those individual claims and trying to meet that evidential burden. And that then impacts the available resources for everyone else. So it's creating a problem whereby people are actually unable to enter the system at all. So anyone who's interested should go and have a read of that as well.
Perhaps a sort of change in culture at the Home Office as well, where they've shifted from being relatively amenable to trafficking cases, because that was the kind of lead they'd been given, to being much more sceptical, because that's now the lead they've been given more recently.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The culture within the Home Office, the attitude towards people who have been trafficked, is hugely troubling. Okay, so now we are moving on to, I've just grouped a bunch of cases together under procedure. Here we go. The first one is Court of Appeal allows Iranian asylum appeal against difficult to understand first tier tribunal decision. I honestly, like, these next few cases have really done my head in writing them all up. Before I was a lawyer, I remember when I was young and naive, and I thought that judges were these very, very clever people who made fair decisions all the time. And, you know, if you ended up in front of a judge, then you'd get the right answer. On to this particular case, the Court of Appeal described the first tier tribunal's decision at various points as inexplicable, badly expressed, incoherent, difficult to interpret, unintelligible, all but meaningless, and many spelling mistakes and other errors of expression. This, to me, does not sound as though the person who wrote that decision should be a judge, let alone one who is deciding asylum cases where someone's life is at issue. The upper tribunal, however, thought that decision was great, which is why it ended up in the Court of Appeal. I know from experience that the tribunal is generally uninterested in dealing with issues like this, so I expect that this judge will just continue on as before. And the troubling point there, obviously, is that not everyone will be able to make it to the Court of Appeal. Colin, I shared these out, so you get to do the next one.
Yeah, the next one's kind of, in some ways, a mirror image. So it's another one where it's a really bad quality first-tier tribunal decision. And the judge is named in this one. I'm not going to name them on the podcast. Don't know why, but I'm not going to. And it's then overturned by the upper tribunal, and the Court of Appeal decide to restore the first-tier tribunal decision. But it's very much despite the errors in the first-tier tribunal rather than because of. And this judgment's by Lord Justice Underhill. The title of the post is Court of Appeal demolishes first-tier tribunal in deportation appeal but upholds decision. It's Yalcin against Secretary of State for the Home Department, 2024, EWCA Civ 74. And it's, as I think it's Nick Nason, who is one of our long-standing contributors, but is very busy these days, so we don't get that many contributions for him, but they're always gems when they come in. And he starts this one by saying, you know, it's bad when there are so many mistakes in your determination that the appellate court judge decides he's only going to write sick next to the really big ones. The Court of Appeal judge, Lord Justice Underhill, silently corrects the other typographical errors. So it's really bad, basically. It's really bad. But the problem here is that they'd found in favor of the appellant, the claimant, in a deportation case. The reasons were very badly expressed, but intelligible. And the upper tribunal had been wrong to overturn that decision. There was no error of law, basically, the Court of Appeal finds. It's an interesting one if you're doing deportation cases, though, because Lord Justice Underhill has dealt with this several times previously in the Court of Appeal. He's probably got a very good, arguably one of the best understandings of how this works in the judiciary. And when he kind of tries to explain how it's supposed to work, then it's worth paying attention, basically. I'm not going to go through it all right now, but it's all to do with the exceptional circumstances over and above requirement in Part 5A of the 2002 Act, which was inserted by the, God, it was the 2014 legislation, I think, wasn't it? Yeah, it's kind of an interesting one for very poor quality but upheld first-tier tribunal decision, but it's also interesting on the deportation law stuff that comes out of it too.
And I mean, anyone who is interested in who these judges are, you just go and look at the upper tribunal's decision. I'm fairly confident they are named in both of those cases.
Yeah, they used to often not name the first tier, which used to irritate me, but I haven't really, I confess, I haven't really noticed if there's been a change of policy or if it's all just kind of accidental and sort of, you know, different upper tribunal judges approach it differently or what.
I feel like I looked at one of them and the judge was named, so I'm not sure about the second one, but, you know, for anyone who thinks it's helpful knowledge for them to have, then knock yourself out. Okay, next is me. The article is Rewarding Failure, Home Secretary Permitted to Withdraw Decision Under Appeal Following Failure to Admit Excluded Evidence. The case is Malici, non-admission of late evidence in the upper tribunal. Essentially, the Home Office failed to comply with appeal directions to the point that the first tier tribunal ordered that evidence be excluded. They were obviously given many opportunities to comply with the orders. They were warned that if there was no non-compliance, then the evidence would be excluded. They ignored the orders. They didn't apply for an extension of time, the usual thing. So once the evidence had been ordered excluded by the first tier tribunal, the Home Office then sought to withdraw the decision under challenge, which would bring the appeal to an end. The judge did not allow this, saying that withdrawal of the decision would, in my judgment, simply reward failure. The presenting officer then declined to cross-examine or make a closing speech. He accepted that without the excluded evidence, there was little to rely on. So the first tier allowed the appeal. The Home Secretary appealed on the basis that the judge did not have the power to refuse to allow the Home Office to withdraw the decision, as opposed to using a power that the judge does have, which is a limited discretion to decide whether or not the appeal should continue. So the upper tribunal agreed that it was correct that the judge did not have the power to prevent withdrawal, and that decision seemed right to me. The bad bit is that the upper tribunal then set out a non-comprehensive list of what would and would not be a good reason for the judge to use the discretion and for the appeal to continue. So, for example, they expressly stated that where the withdrawal of the decision is for reasons the judge considers inappropriate, this is very unlikely to be a good reason to proceed. The example given was where a presenting officer seeks adjournment of a hearing and when refused, withdraws the decision under challenge. The upper tribunal says that withdrawal is fine and the appeal should be ended in those circumstances. And as I said at the end of the article, I think this is another decision where it may well lead to more abuse of Rule 17 withdrawals at appeal hearings where the Home Office does not get its way from the first tier tribunal.
I haven't read the decision. Do they say anything about costs in those kind of situations, though? Because if they withdraw the appeal after really screwing up their litigation, getting an adjournment refused and all that kind of thing, I'm really, you should be getting your costs.
Yes, they do not mention costs in there, but absolutely anyone who is in that situation should robustly be asking for their costs.
Which is no consolation for, you know, having to go to the back of an increasingly long appeals queue. I mean, the appeal waiting times are going to get horrendous.
You need to wait for your new decision first as well.
Yeah. Yeah, although they're churning those out at the moment, aren't they? Okay, I think it's my turn now, isn't it? So this is yet another pretty shocking case. And in fact, it's even in the blog post title, Home Secretary's shockingly poor handling of case did not amount to contempt of court. And shockingly poor in quotes there, because that's what the judge said. And this is a really awful case, and it's a very sad case, I think, as well, because it's a stateless Palestinian academic and journalist, past Chevening scholar, completed a master's degree at SOAS, left the UK, no breach of immigration rules or whatever, as far as we can see, and then she's awarded another scholarship to undertake a PhD at the London School of Economics, and that was back in 2021. And you know, over the next 2 years, this is just kind of litany of refusals and very poor conduct by the Secretary of State, where they haven't been at all clear with the applicant what's been going on. In fact, her case ended up being refused on security grounds. Her ability to challenge was funneled through to SEAC. She wasn't told about any of this. She was trying to bring conventional challenges in the meantime. And it's just appalling. That the sort of icing on the cake for all that is that the Home Office gave undertakings that they couldn't fulfill. The question was whether that amounted to contempt of court, the failure to fulfill them, and the upper tribunal with a high court judge sitting. So it's Mrs. Justice Steyn, DBE, who makes this decision. But the upper tribunal decides that it's not contempt of court, but was clearly very, very critical of the Home Office and, to an extent, government legal department conduct in this case, none of which will be any consolation to the person who's affected.
Next, I'm just going to briefly mention an article on a Scottish case, a Scottish development. This is Judicial Review, no longer the appropriate remedy to challenge age assessments in Scotland. And essentially, this is just to flag up that there has been a change in process for age assessment legal challenges in Scotland, and that is to do with the need for fact-finding in age assessment cases. So if you deal with those in Scotland, then do have a read of that if you haven't already. Next, we're moving on to points-based system articles. And the first one I'm just going to mention is Migration Advisory Committee recommends 21 occupations for the new immigration salary list following rapid review. Late last year, the committee recommended that the shorter occupation list is abolished, and in the meantime, they had recommended only 8 roles remain on it. Now, I find this quite interesting, and I don't usually find Migration Advisory Committee things very interesting, but because of
shock, horror, shock.
But because of the huge increase to the salary thresholds for skilled workers, they have had to add more roles to the list. So the list is now back up to 21, still lower than it was before, but obviously that's a lot higher than 8. I find the relationship between the committee and the government quite interesting, and becoming more interesting. The committee has essentially said to the Home Secretary that they cannot carry out a full review of what roles should be on the list unless the government first identifies what the remaining benefits to the list are. I guess we see how the government responds to that, but I just found it quite interesting. They were like, you need to explain what is the point of any of this before we do anything else. The next one I'm also just going to briefly mention. So this is a briefing on the immigration implications of a corporate transaction, and it covers things like impact of a share sale on a sponsorship license, impact of an asset sale on sponsored employees, impact of a merger on a sponsorship license, consequences of failing to carry out the necessary actions in respect of a sponsor license, prevention of illegal working, and TUPE, which is the transfer of undertakings for the protection of employees, and an immigration lawyer's role in the due diligence process. So if you deal with any of those, this is a really useful explainer of how it all works and what people should be doing. Next.
Oh, this one's me, isn't it? So it's the Shamima Begum Court of Appeal decision. So it's the latest installment in sort of long-running series of different cases that she's been involved with, basically. This one is on the substance of her citizenship deprivation decision. So the case, when it previously went up to the Supreme Court, was a lot of it was to do with procedural issues, actually, about whether she should be back in the UK. This is actually on the substance of it, and she runs a number of different grounds in this one. Essentially, the first two are to do with whether she was trafficked and whether that was relevant to the Secretary of State's decision. The Secretary of State's power is basically that the Secretary of State is empowered to deprive a British citizen of their citizenship if the Secretary of State considers it would be conducive to the public good. Now, immigration lawyers will recognise that those words from the test for deportation. It's been the test for deportation since, I think, 1914 or something like that, the first time you see conducive to the public good appearing in immigration legislation. And the idea that you can be deprived of your citizenship under basically what could be interpreted as the same test, quite remarkable. So anyway, first two grounds are to do with trafficking. Next one is to do with the fact that she would be rendered effectively stateless, this issue about whether she might be a citizen of Bangladesh or not. The fourth ground of appeal to do with procedural fairness, natural justice, failure to allow her to make representations before the decision. And then the fifth ground is to do with the public sector equality duty and sort of wider impact of this kind of policy of deprivation. And she loses on all of them, basically. And in some ways, it's kind of no surprise, because when you've got such a wide power, the courts are bound to defer to the Secretary of State. That's kind of just how things work in the British Constitution. But I think, Sonia, and you wrote this one up yourself. You were saying that you thought there were some genuinely quite shocking bits of the judgment.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was directing people to your write-up of the SIAC decision, just because it was all the rants that I wanted to do were in your article, basically. And the SIAC the Court of Appeal decision mirrored SIAC to quite a large extent. The point about the statelessness, I think in order for her to be able to have Bangladesh citizenship, I think she needed to have actively done something before she turned 21. That wasn't an option on a practical level, because I think Bangladesh had said that the death penalty was on offer for her if she went there. But I think that that's no longer an option because she is aged out of that process. And so the outcome of this is that she will be stateless. I think that's it anyway.
I think you're right about that. It's kind of, and it's this, academics talk about this kind of race to the bottom. That's like the race to deprive somebody of their citizenship, because if you're the last state where somebody's got multiple nationalities, then if you're the last state to act, you can't, because you'll render them stateless. But I suppose the Bangladeshi state either just did it anyway, even though she'd be stateless, or it was some sort of default operation of law.
I think it is a default one. So yeah, it's been a while since that element of the litigation has been addressed in detail, but sort of vaguely in the back of my head, I think it was a default process and you had to actively do something. Anyway, without really remembering the details, I shouldn't be talking about it as though this is what happened. But I do think that if she is unsuccessful in this appeal, which will presumably now go to the Supreme Court, I think she will be stateless. And she's currently, I think, living in a refugee camp.
Yeah, yeah. It's just an absolutely horrendous situation and case. But like I say, it's the underlying power and how easily it can be exercised that I think is really problematic here. But yeah, hopefully the Supreme Court will be a bit more proactive about things, but you know, not holding out much hope with its current composition.
I mean, the stuff around voluntariness, and I found that, and again, like you did a really good rant about it in your SIAC article, but that just really, really troubling. And it's difficult to see the recognition. I mean, they do talk about the fact that she was a child who has been trafficked, but there seems to be a disconnect between that and then them saying, well, her travel was voluntary. So that is an issue that it just doesn't feel has been grappled with in a proper way by the courts before now. So we'll see what happens in the Supreme Court.
I think the next one's one of yours, isn't it?
Family immigration, I've put this under. So the first one is Statement of Changes, HC 556, Home Office shuts Ukraine family scheme without notice. I put it under family immigration because it just affects families generally. I mean, we knew about this statement of changes and that it would be removing the ability of care workers to bring their families. However, what no one knew about in advance was that the Ukraine family scheme was going to be closed with no notice. I think the scheme closed about 4 hours after this statement of changes was published. The day before the announcement, in what does seem like a bit of a cynical move, the government was trumpeting the fact that people already here under the Ukrainian schemes would be able to apply for an additional 18 months of leave starting early next year in 2025. So obviously that's where they wanted the attention to be. But then, yeah, the next day there was this announcement that the family scheme would be closing with immediate effect. There was a very disingenuous line from someone in government, I can't remember who it was, that the Homes for Ukraine scheme could be used instead. But actually, they also changed that in this statement of changes and made it a lot more restrictive in who can sponsor people to come here. You essentially have to be British or settled now. I think since then, the government has said that the concern and the people who they are trying to stop using this process is Ukrainians who have come here under one of these schemes. They want to stop them from being able to bring their families. I mean, I don't have much to say about that is fit to go out on air. The other thing I just wanted to flag up is that we have just launched a webinar on what options people in Ukraine have following these changes to still come to the UK. So the webinar is on the 15th of April, and it is presented by the brilliant Luke Piper and Dimitri McMillan from Work Rights Centre. Dimitri is also at Wesley Grick, and I will put a link for booking that in the episode description for the podcast. On to you next, Colin.
Thanks, Anya. So this is a quick one to mention. It's actually a really long, really detailed, incredibly useful blog post. It's from Naf Gbikpi, one of our longtime contributors, and it's good to see her back contributing something to the blog. This is one of the issues that she's done a lot of work on. I think she was behind one of the big cases on this, or the big case on this. So it's to do with entry clearance for victims of transnational marriage abandonment. Now, this is essentially victims of domestic violence, but where the victim ends up being ditched abroad. And you don't it doesn't require you to have children. They don't have to be children as part of the relationship. But the cases that I used to come across, you know, quite a long time ago, we used to call them stranded spouses when I was doing my pupillage. It was often that there were children. And basically, it's like a really, really sort of convenient form of child abduction in a way, where instead of having to leg it to another country and take the children with you, you could go on holiday somewhere else and then either just by simply even taking your spouse's passport home with you and leaving them abroad, or by writing to the Home Office and saying that the relationship was over or something like that. So the Home Office kind of cancelled their leave or wouldn't let them back in, something along those lines. And then you can travel back to your own country with the kids. And there was very little, basically, that spouses in that situation could do. And thanks to some brilliant work and some brilliant campaigning by quite a few people, including Nath, I think, there is now an actual formal immigration route in the rules to allow people in this kind of situation, I say, including without children. You don't have to have children to apply for entry clearance and re-enter the UK and potentially even achieve settlement. So Nath's done a really good run through of the rules, the kind of evidence that's required, what to do if you can't afford the extortionate fee and all those sorts of things. So really highly recommend that if you come across anybody in that kind of situation. I think there's another one for me quickly to mention, which is not dissimilar, changes to the destitute domestic violence concession. And this is to do with the concession which allows you, as I understand it, to get a 3-month period of leave while you're kind of pursuing an application for ILR. Now, that was applicable only to people who could qualify for settlement, so spouses of British citizens and people who are already settled here. But the concession has now been extended also to people who are partners of temporary migrants, so for example, skilled workers or something like that, or students, but they don't qualify for ILR. So you can get this potential 3-month period of leave, but you still don't qualify for ILR. So there's been kind of mixed bag here, where people have welcomed the fact that the concession has been introduced, and it's quite good to some extent, but it's also been condemned because it just doesn't go far enough. Oh, and there's another one from me. So these are another two blog posts to quickly mention. This is part of a long-running series. We mentioned some earlier blog posts, I think, last month from John Vassiliou and his colleagues up in Scotland. And I think we've reached 4 parts now to this series. 3 parts, is it? And it's about basically the kind of wider issues that arise from relocating to the UK around tax, property, inheritance tax, domicile, and all these kinds of things. So the two to give you a quick mention to now are what you need to know before buying a property in the United Kingdom. And John is very keen to emphasize that buying property does not create immigration rights. Says that right at the start. And I'll just read you out his last subheading. Will owning property in the UK help me get a visa? No. And that's how he ends that blog post. So I think he's trying to make a point there. What are you trying to tell us there, John, really? And then the other one is, what are the UK's inheritance tax rules? It's to do with basically domicile inheritance tax when you move to the UK, when that sort of gets triggered, when it's UK or England and Wales or Scottish law or whatever, which governs your will and how things get divided up. So if you are interested in these things or need to know about them, then there's a very useful reference point for you there.
Then finally, I just wanted to mention a few articles that we updated over the last month. And the first one is applying for British citizenship by naturalization, and John Vassiliou updated that one. I think it was originally written by Colin. Then we also updated how to apply for leave to remain as a victim of domestic violence. February was a very domestic violence heavy month for updates and new articles. And that one was just updated to take account of the new appendix domestic violence, I think it's called. And then also, what is the immigration health surcharge and how much does it cost? And we updated that because it now costs a lot more than it used to. So that is it for us for February. I promised that we'd get this one out a lot faster than we did January roundup, and we've done that.
I think I never fully owned the fact that those delays were entirely due to me, Sonia. I think you were very careful not to blame me, but it was all my fault. So I'm sorry,
like,
everybody.
The first postponement was at least mutual, but then it was half term, and you were living it up in the Canaries or something, weren't you?
I was. It was nice and sunny. I came back heavier than I went as well.
That is the perfect holiday. All right, so that is it for us for February, and we'll be back next month to talk all things March. Thanks, everyone.
Goodbye.
Bye.